It's a pleasure to announce today's first speaker. We have Falko Dulat talking about computing Higgs production at Three Loops in QCD. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Ollie. Thanks for the introduction. And let me first thank the organizers, of course, for inviting me to speak here. And thanks for all of you for coming to this early session after the great dinner last night. So we've heard a lot about amplitudes in this conference, well, as the name would suggest, and we've heard a lot about correlation functions and form factors. And these are very interesting objects to study, and amplitudes are a great thing to compute. But now imagine that you've computed some amplitude, and now you're getting ballsy, and you want to see whether what you've computed there is something that you might actually find in nature. So you want somebody to measure something that you've computed. Now, if you go to your favorite experimentalist and tell them, look, I have this amplitude here. Take two helicity plus gluons with these energies and shoot them at each other, and at three loops, they will produce four helicity minus gluons, and measure that for me, please. Well, probably they'll kick you out of your office, of their office immediately, because, of course, well, we all know that you cannot just go ahead and measure an amplitude. So if you really want to have something that you can find in nature, you have to jump through a few more hoops. And there are some objects that you can compute if you want to be able to see them somewhere in nature, and these are cross-sections. So what I want to talk to you about today are cross-sections and how you come from amplitudes to cross-sections. And I want to do this in a rather special theory, on the example of Higgs production, in a theory that is, n equals zero, non-supersymmetric, also non-planar and non-conformal, and, well, you may say rather boring, but I hope to convince you that actually it's not such a boring theory. And of course, the theory I'm talking about is, well, Young-Mills theory with additional matter in the fundamental representation, or as some know it, as QCD. So I want to talk to you about production of a particular scalar, color-neutral scalar in QCD today. And the idea is to compute the cross-section so that somebody, well, particular people in Geneva here in Switzerland at the LHC, could go ahead and actually measure this thing that we're computing. So, told you the object that you need for that is a cross-section. But if you think back to your QCD lectures in grad school, even computing cross-sections sort of is a bit of a problem if you want to measure something, because you build cross-sections from pieces that are rather divergent. And we all know that we sort of have to regularize these divergences. Usually you do that in dimensional regularization. You, rather than computing something in four dimensions, you compute it in d dimensions, and then you continue it to four dimensions, and you pick up poles and epsilon, and you can compute something. But when you put these things together, there's still something that remembers that you computed something that is infinite. And that is when you, of course, if you go from four dimensions to d dimensions in your Lagrangian, if you just do that, your coupling constants, as you all know from the quantum field theory, your coupling constants become dimensionful. So you have to introduce something that compensates this dimension, and that is usually called, usually just referred to as some scale. Usually you name it a little mu. And this scale, you have to put it there so that your thing makes mathematical sense. But it's if you start computing now some cross-section, it will depend on this scale mu. But this scale mu, you just introduce it to regularize something. So it's sort of an unphysical parameter. And it's, in the end, it's really an artifact of the fact that you're doing perturbation theory. If you were to compute some cross-section at all orders in your coupling constant, then this shouldn't be there. However, of course, I guess it will still be some time until Ahmed and friends will compute QCD cross-sections at all loop orders for us. So for the moment, we sort of have to make do with what we have. And that is, if you sort of slowly approach the all-loop result, meaning you compute to higher and higher order in your perturbative expansion, the cross-sections will depend less and less on that scale. And that is, of course, something that you want, because this, as I said, the scale is unphysical. It's not like you can just measure it in some process, take this value from there, plug it everywhere. It's an unphysical parameter. It doesn't have any meaning as such. So what you want to do is you want to have something that depends less and less on this scale, and that is why people compute higher and higher order corrections in perturbation theory to cross-sections. So I can actually show you this here. I have a small plot prepared. So this is the cross-section that we will compute later. It's Higgs cross-section, and the exact numbers are not so important. But what's important here is that this is the cross-section as parameter, as function of this unphysical scale giving relative to the 125 GeV. And you can see that if you pick different values for the scale, you can basically get almost any number you want. I mean, you see that this function goes rather steeply up here and even steeper here. And you can see that you basically, if you compare the value here and here, you get a variation by a factor of 2. So this physical cross-section that you wanted to compute, that somebody should be able to measure, still somehow is in a way a bit problematically defined because you still depend on this parameter. However, luckily, if you compare the different colored lines here, so this is the leading order cross-section, sort of the classical thing. It's not supposed to give you a quantitative result anyway. But if you start looking at next leading order and compare it, for example, to the next leading order in blue here, you see that the variation that you get at next to next leading order, if you change this parameter, while it's still there, it's considerably smaller than what you get in this orange line here. So that sort of makes your theory more predictive, of course, if you go higher and higher, because you don't know what to pick for this parameter, but it doesn't matter so much what you pick. And so the hope is that if you go even higher, that it will become flatter and flatter, and you can pick whatever you want, and in the end you'll sort of get the same number, and you can sort of have the prediction that somebody, for example, at the LHC could measure. So if we make predictions for the LHC, considering that it's a proton-proton collider, there's lots of gluons flying around in, at these energies, and the sort of dominant way of making a Higgs at the LHC is through what's called gluon fusion. So you take two gluons that are radiated by the protons that they're colliding, and these sort of form a top virtual top loop here, this triangle, that then radiates out a Higgs. That's how you compute this process at leading order. And your standard model, that's what you have. However, that's sort of not so pretty from the point of view of computing things, because, I mean, this thing already at leading order starts at one loop. Before, I was talking about next and next to leading order, so you basically add two loops to that. So that gets very, very complicated very quickly. And furthermore, you have the top here running. The gluons are nice, of course. They're massless. That's what we like. Well, they're external anyway, so we don't care. But we have an internal top here, which is, of course, very, very massive. And so that means we have to do integrals over over massive propagators. And as we've heard in the nice talks by Olli and company, that these functions that you can get there, the elliptic functions, are still very much an active field of study, and this is not solved yet. So ideally, we would not want to wait for integrals with massive internal lines being solved at 2 and 3 loops and so on. So it would be nice if we could somehow get rid of this massive loop for computing things. So what if we were just to compute this here? We just take two gluons and attach them to the Higgs, and maybe we can compute with that. That, of course, would make things much easier, because at leading order you just start at tree level, which is sort of what you want. And you just make QCD corrections to that, so everything remains massless and you're happy and you can compute things. And as a matter of fact, that is not just some random model that you can cook up and calculate things and it won't tell you anything in the end. But in fact, you can rigorously obtain this from QCD with massive fermions by going to the limit of infinitely heavy fermions and building an effective theory. And then this vertex here, this black dot, will be an effective operator in this theory, dimension 5, it's written here, that couples gluons to the Higgs directly. Of course, it will come with the Wilson coefficient that somebody has to calculate for you, but there's people that do that. So what we can really do is we can work in this effective theory where we don't have to concern ourselves with massive internal particles. And In this theory now, we want to compute the nth3LO that is next to next to next leading order corrections, because everything up to next to next leading order is basically known, and the next important corrections will be the ones that go one order higher in the coupling constant of QCD. So what we want to compute is sort of, we just look at the particle level, it's somehow we get two gluons, and they go in some amplitude up to three loops, and emit us a Higgs boson in the end. And if you remember the nice diagram that Nigel was showing on the first talk on Monday morning, stole it here, where you have the comparison between high-precision computations with lots of loops and high-multiplicity computations with lots of legs, it's of course clear that we're pretty much here on the high-precision side, because of, in the end, the goal is sort of to understand this Higgs boson very, 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 very well now that it has been discovered. So the sort of the direct discovery high multiplicity branch has been taken care of. So now what's up to us is this high precision many loops thing. And we're, as I said, we're going up to three loops, so it's quite a few loops, at least in QCD. Now, unfortunately, the experimentalists didn't build us a collider that collides gluons, unfortunately. We told them they should just collide some gluons, but for some reason they're not going to do it. So we have to make do with the fact that they're colliding protons for us. Now, protons are, of course, pretty messy objects. There's a lot of crap flying around when you shoot two protons at each other. So you somehow have to make a description that still allows you to do nice computation. Now, of course, this is the factorization theorem of QCD, which tells you you can factor this load of crap here, the proton flying from your hot process in a specific way. And so the idea is you describe this with some measured quantities, which you call the PDFs, the parton density functions, which tell you the probability to get a certain a gluon with a certain energy. You describe them with these measured quantities, but then you have a gluon which is going at rather high energies, so then you're in the asymptotically free limit of QCD, and you can do a hot scattering calculation where you forget about this stuff here, and you just say, okay, now I have two gluons coming in, and I want to do stuff with that. So here is it in written form. This is basically the product of these two PDFs describing the two gluons. The two protons, and you have to do an integral over them because you don't care so much what kind of energy gluon you get from them, so you just integrate over all possible energies that the gluons might have. And then you have this object sigma hat here, which is what we call the partonic cross-section. So this is really the object that only knows about gluons. You have two incoming gluons, and you collide them, you produce a Higgs. And this is the object that we want to compute in the end imperturbative QCD up to and next to next to next leading order, which is the alpha s to the fifth coefficient. Now you also have this tau here and this L. As this L is sort of the description of the two protons, so that together with the tau, which sort of parameterizes the energy of the collider, describes your experiment. This is all you need to, at least at this level, describe the fact that this is the LHC and not the Tevatron, for example. These things are distinguished by the values of tau and L. But the sort of universal thing is really this partonic cross-section, and this is what we're going to try to compute now. Now, this, but of course, people have studied this before, and as I said, this has been computed at next and next leading order, and at N3LO, only approximations were known basically until the beginning of last year when we had our first results. And when we started this project, the question was, can we push perturbative QCD to N3LO? Can we go one order higher in this computation? Of course, many of you are working in much, much nicer theories than QCD, so the question was really, is it possible to do such a computation, even in an ugly theory with all these properties that I showed in my first slide, like QCD? Is it possible to compute at this high order? And what will happen? Will we find something interesting? I mean, you can do computations in QCD and find unexpected things. So these were the questions that were asked before. And, of course, also people wanted, so here are the different orders in the perturbative expansions with their corresponding prediction for the LHC, and people wanted to sort of see that this perturbative expansion stabilizes. You want to see that you're expanding in alpha S, which at these energies is small, so your perturbative expansion alpha S should converge at some point. So you would like to see that whatever number you get here is not suddenly 100% correction at this level, because then you're going to seriously start thinking what the hell is going on there. So you want to see something that sort of stabilizes the whole situation. So we tried to do this calculation, and, well, just a quick reminder, when you calculate a cross-section, of course, it's a bit different than when you just calculate an amplitude. In the amplitudes, we have heard about many, many orders of loops and amplitudes, but for a cross-section, as I said before, you want it to be something finite in the end. So for every loop that you have, you have sort of these virtual corrections in our process, you need to add the corresponding real corrections. Very, very textbook-like. And both of them will have divergences, right? The loop, of course, alone can have UV and IR divergences, but also this real emission here can have a divergence when this gluon here, for example, becomes collinear to, for example, the leg that it is emitted from. In that case, you will get a divergence. And if you do it in dimensional regularization, this will become a pole and epsilon. And if you do things correctly and you calculate this thing and you add them together, in the end, your poles and epsilon should cancel and you will get a finite value add. So at next leading order, you have to combine these things nicely. So you have, for example, here the you need the one loop amplitude with zero extra emissions, which was be this guy here. You interfere this, of course you have to always square the amplitude, so you multiply this with the zero loop amplitude with zero extra emissions, so just the vertex basically. And then in addition, at the same order in alpha S, you have the zero loop amplitude with one extra emission, which is this guy here, which just gets squared. Now if you put these things together and you don't screw up too much, you'll get a finite prediction out in the end. Now, so far what I've been telling you about was about amplitudes or matrix elements, but I was telling you that we have to compute a different object, the cross-section. And when we compute a cross-section, there is basically two ingredients. In blue here, we have the amplitude, or the amplitude square, which is what I've been talking about so far. But I was telling you just now that in this amplitude, there is a component where you emit a real gluon. But what we want to compute is we want to compute Higgs production. We don't want to compute Higgs plus a gluon, so we don't care about this extra gluon. So sort of we should average it out over any possible direction and momentum it can have. So that means you have to do what we call a phase-space integral. So any additional radiation, gluons or quarks or whatever, you have to integrate it out over any possible value of momentum it can have, because you don't want to measure this thing. You just want to know, is there a Higgs coming or not? You don't care if there's an additional gluon coming or not. So you have to do this phase-space integral. So after you've computed your amplitude, you're only halfway done. You have to integrate out any additional stuff. So this is how you compute a cross-section, at least in the textbook case. Now, of course, we have heard many, many great techniques of how we can compute amplitudes nicely. But doing this additional stuff here, the second half of the calculation, we haven't heard so much about yet. And what I want to try to tell you now is that actually we can just do these things sort of in one go and shoehorn everything together and benefit greatly from the advancements in calculating amplitudes. So sort of at the heart of combining these things is, again, very, very textbook like the optical theorem, which you all know from quantum field theory, which tells you that basically the imaginary part of a loop integral gives you the a phase-space integral. Or put differently, you can calculate the discontinuities of loop integrals using what's called Katkowski's rule, which tells you that if you want the discontinuity of a loop integral which has a propagator like this, p squared minus some mass, and here we have our Feynman epsilon prescription, then you can turn it into this object delta plus here, which is a momentum-conserving delta function. So you have, which is just written as delta p squared minus m squared, which is the on-shellness condition for this particle to be real. And then you have the Heaviside function of the energy of the particle, meaning you only select positive energy solutions. And this makes it a real particle because you want your real particles to be on shell and have positive energy. So this is just textbook quantum field theory telling you how to get these discontinuities. But what you can do now, and this was realized basically 15 years ago when people calculated the next leading order, is that you can also take this Katkowski rule and read it sort of backwards, saying if you have a phase space integral, you're already starting with real particles that are supposed to be on shell and have positive energy. But now you read it backwards. You say, I can write such a real particle. I can just write it as the discontinuity of a virtual particle. So what you can do is you can replace your phase space integrals, which have this cut here, which tells you that these particles are supposed to be on shell. You replace it with imaginary parts or discontinuities of loop integrals. That's, of course, a very neat thing because it allows you sort of to phrase this problem of doing the phase space integral over your amplitude. It allows you to phrase this in terms of amplitudes, more or less, because you have here now, instead of saying, okay, I take this amplitude, I multiply it with this amplitude, then I have something that I take and put into something that calculates the phase space integral for me, I can now sort of fuse these things with these two cut propagators here, which tells me that these particles will eventually be put on shell. But for the moment, I can just treat this as sort of a forward scattering amplitude. Yeah, this is one of my, let's say my P1, P2, and then I also have again P1, P2, so this is a forward scattering amplitude, but I will take a particular cut of this forward scattering amplitude. In any case, the point is that this allows you to sort of map this problem of doing phase space integrals back onto an amplitude problem. And this is what we use to do our calculation, because now we don't have to sort of distinguish between these two stages that I was showing you before, but we just compute scattering amplitudes with cuts. And this is nice because now we can use all these tools that have been developed over many, many years to do loop calculations. For example, we can do integration by parts identities, which you have already heard a bit about from Lorenzo, for example. We can use this to reduce phase space integrals to master integrals. So instead of calculating thousands or how many ever phase space integrals, you just have to compute a handful of master integrals. And even newer now, what we're using is that you can, once you have reductions for these two master integrals, you can also derive differential equations. So instead of having to sit down and parameterize a phase space, you can just write down a differential equation and solve it. And we have heard from Lorenzo and Johannes how to do that, and I will show a bit more about that soon. So how do we get these different contributions? Unfortunately, since we're talking about something that goes up to three loops in QCD and has some additional emissions that we have to integrate out, unfortunately, this goes beyond any unitarity or on-shellness methods that you could possibly apply for simple processes in QCD. So what we have to do, really, is we have to sit down and do a textbook calculation where we write down all the Feynman diagrams that contribute to the process. We calculate them more or less one by one, and we add them up. And in the end, we hopefully get out something meaningful. And there are about 100,000 Feynman diagrams in this process that we all have to compute and all have to put together because in QCD with dimensional regularization and everything, of course, you cannot just do some nice on-shell techniques as cool as that would be. So maybe it's a good idea to take a look and slowly check what actually these 100,000 Feynman diagrams are. Don't worry, I'm not going to show all of them. But we can sort of classify the diagrams. And we can first look at next leading order, so that's the first correction. We've seen this before. We have the virtual corrections, and we have the real corrections. And now I'm always drawing these Feynman diagrams in this reverse unitarity sense. So this is basically one matrix element, and this is the conjugate matrix element that have been multiplied together in when you square them to calculate the cross-section. And this is the cut, which tells you which particles are being put on shells. So here you just have the one-loop correction interfered with the tree level, and here you have the square of the single emission. As I said before, both are individually divergent. We have to add them together. And even after we add them together, we still have some divergences left. So we actually have to do UV renormalization, and we have to introduce some counter terms in which go together with the PDFs to regularize potential initial state collinear divergences. But this is a well-understood problem, so we can focus on the actual matrix elements or amplitudes here. next leading order, of course, you have one more power in the coupling constant, so you get more combinatorics. You can have the two-loop interfere with the tree level, or you can have now the emission of two real gluons, squared, of course, and you get one additional contribution of a type that we didn't have before, and that is now you can combine these two things. You can combine loops and loops and real emissions, and you get the one loop correction to the emission of one extra gluon. Now, at NQBLO, the situation gets even more complicated. We can now start with three-loop corrections that are being interfered with the tree level. And on the other end, we have the emissions of three real gluons with no additional loops. And now we have three mixtures in between. We can have the two-loop corrections to the emission of one gluon. There are two types here. Once you have the two loops on one side of the cut, and here you can have them on different sides. And also you get the one-loop correction to the emission of two gluons. So there's lots of different classes of Feynman diagrams that contribute to this process, and sort of you have to go one by one through these processes and compute these guys. Now, actually, the purely loop corrections are, which just have three loops on one side, are actually had been taken care of before we even started the process, because that is nothing than the QCD form factor. And we have heard before already, form factors are objects that are being studied in their own right, and also in QCD, people have studied these form factors at different loop orders, and since this process is so simple, we can just reuse for the purely virtual corrections this form factor. So that was easy, but what about the rest? So the rest, the other contributions that we have, they have all one thing in common. They involve all at least one additional gluon being emitted into the through the cut, so one additional real gluon that we have to integrate over. So that means we have to do lots of phase-space integrals. And phase-space integrals are a bit tricky, because we can understand that, because if you think a bit abstract what a loop integral is, a loop integral is just some integral over Cartesian product of d-dimensional Minkowski space, so you have your d minus one space-time dimensions and one time dimension, and you're just taking sort of an L-fold Cartesian product of that, and you're integrating over the space, over all of space, unconstrained. So that is still pretty straightforward. But now if you want to do a phase-space integral, things become a bit more tricky. Because the phase-space integrals are not just integrals over all of space, but in fact we get some particular varieties here, which are given by the fact that, okay, we have n particles in the phase-space that we want to integrate over. So these can of course have momenta in normal d-dimensional Minkowski space. But now we get these constraints. We want these particles to be real. So the p-square of each particle has to be zero in the case of gluons, because that means that they're on shell. And also we, of course, have momentum conservation. So these constraints sort of define you a less trivial integration region that you have to integrate over. And you sort of have to find now local coordinates on this variety in order to be able to do this integral, which is then usually called, these coordinates usually people refer to as phase-space parameterizations. You have to somehow parameterize this integrand in order to do an integral over whatever this shape this defines. So ideally, of course, we would like to do as few as possible of these integrals because, as I said, they're a bit tricky. So this is now where this reverse unitarity thing helps us massively, because we can now do integral reductions. So in dimensional regularization, of course, you have that the integral over a total derivative vanishes just by construction. And if you now apply this derivative to whatever your integrant here is, to the propagators, you can get, because of the linearity of the integral, of course, relations between different integrals. You just apply the derivative and you pull this thing apart. You get relations between different integrals. And this can be done at the loop level, but it can also be done for phase-space integrals now because of reverse unitarity. So, for example, a trivial example could be that you have such a bubble here. The thick line is a massive propagator, and you multiply it with the loop momentum k, and you differentiate then with respect to k. And then you can work this out. You will get one contribution, which is just the bubble itself coming with some algebraic prefactor. Another contribution you will get where you square one of the propagators because you acted on it with a derivative. This also comes with a prefactor. And then because you also have a mass here, you can also get the tadpole here. So you set one of the massless propagator exponent to zero, and this other guy here remains as a tadpole. Now this is in case if you just have loop integrals, just have a bubble. Now, we can also look at the same thing with the phase-based cut here. So this would be sort of the trivial next leading order phase space for one massive particle and one massless one, signified here by the cut. Again, we can construct with the loop, well, with the momentum of the extra particle here and differentiate with respect to it. We'll see if we actually get the same thing here for this bubble. We'll get the same thing for this dotted bubble here. But then we'll see a difference because we're now missing this tadpole here. And that is because, of course, when we do this cut here, we're basically looking at the discontinuity through these two propagators. But now in the tadpole, I have basically raised one of these propagators, the massless one, to exponent zero. So it will not be a pole. So, of course, I cannot take a monodromy around something that doesn't have a pole there. So this integral will just vanish because I'm looking at the cut. So in the case of if I do these IBP reductions for phase-based integrals, it's very similar to what we do in case of loop integrals, but it simplifies a bit because things that don't have cut, where the cut propagator is raised to exponent zero, just vanish because, yeah, it doesn't have a pole anymore. So with that, we can then we can do this for all the different integrals that we need, and this will give us a linear system that then can be solved with various different computer algebra programs that are tailored to just like air, fire, or reduce, for example, or private codes that we have. And we can solve this linear system, and this solution will be now a basis for all the integrals that appear in our problem, and this basis then we call massive integrals. The nice thing is that this basis will be massively smaller than what we originally have. So in our problem, when we just write down all the Feynman diagrams and look at how many integrals we get something of the order of 10 to the 9 integrals that we would have to do. But after we run this through this IBP reduction process, we come down to less than 1,000 master integrals. That's, of course, a massive reduction in size, and this enables what enables us to do this calculation in the first place, because, well, 1,000 master integrals is still a bit of work, but that we can do. But 10 to the 9 integrals, yeah, you don't want to do that by hand. So we're very lucky to have this reduction. And, yeah, just as an example, for example, here we have a rather complicated-looking integral. You have some numerator insertions here in these dotted lines, which don't really look dotted, but it's not so important. And you have this square propagator here. And then after you run it through the reduction, you get some algebraic prefactor, which, well, it just comes out of the reduction. You don't have to do much work for that. And then it's the coefficient of an integral, which is, you can see every propagator is cut. So this is sort of just the volume of the phase space. You don't have any integrand. You're just calculating over sort of a unit integrand, which is what we call the phase space volume. And this is, of course, much, much easier than something like this here, where you have lots of extra propagators. And so this helps in doing this computation massively. The other thing that I said is that we can have differential equations. Of course, we wouldn't want to parameterize these things by hand. If we can use differential equations to solve these, that would, of course, be great. So we can take differential equations, differentials with respect to external kinematics. In our case, the only external thing that should be remaining after we do the integral is the mass of the Higgs boson, or here written as the relative mass, Z, which is just the mass over the center of mass energy. So we can take a derivative of an integral with respect to that. This will act similar to the way we take IBPs. It will give us some combination of integrals if we actually act with the derivative on the integrand. And these different integrals we can then again IBP reduce to the master integrals. And we will find that we will obtain a linear differential equation. Like, for example, here, whatever this integral is, we act on it with a differential with respect to the mass. And, okay, we find it, of course, the integral itself, which makes it a couple differential equation. And then we find two simpler integrals, which sort of appear in the integral as the inhomogeneities. And so if we do this for all integrals, all master integrals that appear, we get a system of differential equations. We get a linear system. We can just write it like this, differential on our functions, gives us some matrix, which is the system matrix, that gives us the differential equation system. Now, formally, we know how to solve something like this. We can just take the path-ordered exponential of the integral over the system matrix, acting on some array, some vector of boundary conditions, and we have the solution. But of course, in practice, you may be able to compute this integral up here, but you will never be able to compute this path ordered exponential of an arbitrary matrix, because these matrices, of course, can be rather big and complicated. So if we want to solve such a system, we have to somehow decouple it. Now, luckily, we are only interested in solutions which are Lorentz series in epsilon, another dimensional regulator. So it's enough if we expand in epsilon, so we can just decouple the system in the limit epsilon goes to zero. And we have heard from Johannes and Lorenzo how these how one can deal with such systems, and this usually goes under one way of doing it is looking into these canonical bases that Johannes has suggested, which are simply the idea that you're trying to find some kind of linear transformation of your integral, which takes it into a nice form which is proportional to epsilon and only has these D-log type singularities, and we've heard how to solve this. And then we can just expand this path ordered exponential, and we're basically immediately in the definition of the multiple polylogarithms. And this way you can solve these differential equations nicely in a set of well-defined functions that have nice analytic properties, and we've heard about these in Eric's talk. Now, of course, finding these canonical bases is not, A, not always possible, and B, it's not always so straightforward. So what we actually did is we said at some point, okay, let's not, we can do something else. In the end, we just want to get out the result. So what we can also do is we can just expand these differential equations in the variable. So we can say we can expand these differential equations in this variable z bar here, which turns them into, instead of having complicated singularity structures, you just pick up this one singularity here, and then you get an infinite power series for the remaining terms, something that you can, of course, do. And such a system, then, is simply solved by a Lorentz series in Z bar. So you get some branch cut prefactors here, and then you just get a power series, basically. And such a system is, of course, simpler to solve because you don't have to find nice functions anymore. You just have to fix these coefficients here somehow. Now, in any case, no matter how you solve differential equations, what you always have to do is you have to fix, after you've found the general solution, you have to specify this general solution using boundary conditions. So you have to sort of know the function at one point which fixes your general solution to be the specific solution that you want. So that means we have to evaluate our Feynman integrals in some limit z, with z goes to z zero here. At this point, we have to know the Feynman integral in order to specify our general solutions. What we do is we choose this so-called soft limit, which is the limit in which, this variable z bar goes to zero. So that means that the center of mass energy that we get into the process from the two gluons is exactly equal to the Higgs mass. That means that the process is just enough energy to produce the Higgs, but there is no additional energy that could be used to produce any hot radiation. So the Higgs is just going to be produced and it's just going to sit there. There's no hot gluons that it can recoil against. And this, of course, greatly simplifies the kinematics, because there will be no hot radiation that you have to take into account. Everything will be soft. And actually, in this limit, this becomes dual to the scattering of Wilson lines. So you can just, instead of having hot gluons coming in here, you can calculate the scattering of two Wilson lines, which, of course, makes this thing very much simpler. But in general, what you want to do is, you can get some boundary conditions like this, but not all of them. So in general, what you want to do is you want to evaluate these master integrals directly in the soft limit. So you need some explicit way of doing that. Let me skip through here. So you sort of have to evaluate these phase-space integrals for Higgs plus 3 gluon, 6 plus 2 gluon, 6 plus 1 gluon, in the limit that everything is becoming soft. And that sort of brings us back to this problem that you sort of have to parameterize this shape here, which in general leads to very, very much complicated integrals. And particularly, you will not be able to find nice linear parameterizations for anything that goes beyond one extra gluon. So there is not a direct analogy to having Feynman parameters like in the loop case. So One thing you can do is since you have massless gluons, you can of course parameterize them in terms of some energy and some direction that they're going. So you have your zero component, which is the energy, and then you're left with a three-dimensional or d minus one-dimensional vector, which you can of course sort of parameterize in terms of Euler angles. So you can do this energy angles parameterization. And luckily then there is a very nice algorithmic way that has been worked out by Gabor Somogyi, how you can do these angular integrals in sort of closed form in terms of Mellin-Barnes integrals. And this sort of allows you to canonically derive integral representations for these complicated phase-space integrals that you then can solve in terms of multiple sums over Euler sums, and you will in the end end up with nice expressions in terms of multiple zeta values. So just very quickly, this is the result that we, for example, found in the first coefficient. It's completely expressed in terms of multiple zeta values. And, I don't want to show you the other coefficients of the expansion analytically because they get very ugly, but I can show you them graphically. So this was the first coefficient, and then we computed higher coefficients in the expansion. And you can see, it at first had some large corrections, then at some point this expansion seems to become very stable, and we obtain sort of the result that we can get from here when we go to like order 30 terms in the Taylor series. And now I can complete this picture that I've shown before. I can show you this sort of result after 30 terms in the expansion, again as a function of this unphysical scale. And if you compare it to the lower orders, you can see that we have achieved our goal of reducing the dependence on this unphysical scale, because you can see this red line here, which is now the N3LO cross-section, is much, much flatter compared to these lower orders. So it doesn't matter so much what value we pick for this unphysical scale. We will always get a value here in this ballpark, so this becomes much more predictive than, say, here, where you could end up with a value down here or up here. Just to say quickly that this is not really something that can be measured in nature. Here is a comparison now of this number that we have obtained, and I think Nigel showed this already on Monday, but I'll just quickly say it again. This is sort of the number that we have obtained, and this is in an evaluation of a study that Atlas has been doing, so a measurement by the Atlas collaboration at the LHC. And you can see this here is their measurement. It still has very, very large statistical uncertainties, but it's at least in the right ballpark compared to our number. So this is really something that can be measured, and this has pushed perturbative QCD to a next level, and it was really made possible with many developments that we have learned from the amplitudes community, and we're excited to calculate more things, of course, at this order in QCD, and who knows, maybe we'll be able to compare different orders in QCD like people are doing it in N equals 4, and maybe we'll learn something. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for this neat presentation. Questions for Falco?
In replacing the fermion loop of a top loop by this effective operator,
yeah,
you're making an error, of course.
Yes.
Can you estimate what your error is?
So there are estimates of lower orders. So at next leading order in QCD, people have calculated corrections. So you can, of course, not only write down a dimension 5 operator in its effective theory, but you can write down dimension 6 and higher, so you get 1 over m top square suppressed terms. And so at next leading order, people have studied this, and they have calculated that this amounts to order per mil effects that were missing there. So, of course, now at N3LO, it's a different game. You can only sort of say, okay, at lower order it was like this, so we can estimate that it would probably be the same, but in the end you can only tell it once somebody goes and calculates this 1 over m top correction to tell you what the next term in this sort of series is, so you can estimate how the series will progress. But yeah, sort of evidence from lower orders suggests that these corrections are very small compared to what you get from pure QCD.
Additional questions? Okay then, let's thank Falco again.